WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org online. The time now is 2 p.m. Stay tuned for She's On Call.
This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues.
Dr. Sekhar from Distant City.
The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions.
What they see, they say,
please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon with practices in New York City and in Wayne, New Jersey.
I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon, and I also do minimally invasive surgery and weight loss surgery in New York City. We have a great show planned today. Lots of things to talk about.
Yeah, we are going to cover the gamut today, Marina. We have wonderful guests. We have Dr. Carrie Yerga, who is a trauma surgeon in California and helps run tactical pre-hospital care. And we have Dr. Michelle Au, who is an anesthesiologist and state senator from Georgia. And we're going to talk to both of these physicians, not only about their professions, but about what it's like to be a physician advocate and how to do that effectively.
Yeah, so definitely stay tuned, because we're going to have so much to talk to them about, from how the epidemic or the pandemic affected women more than disproportionately. And then also, you know, we'll probably touch on opioid crisis and maybe even vaccine hesitancy. We'll see if we get to all of that. We have a full
gun violence.
We're going to get to that, and then also hear their journeys.
So let's start by just giving you guys a quick update on what's going on in the medical world. So 47% of Americans have been vaccinated against COVID, have received at least one vaccine. About 30% have actually received a full complement of vaccines, which is either two of the Pfizer and the Moderna or one of the Johnson & Johnson. And you're considered fully vaccinated about 2 weeks after your final shot. But something about 8% are not showing up for their second shot, which is a real problem. You are not fully vaccinated without that second shot. So Marina, we have the people who are not coming back, and it seems to be
there's some discrepancy, right? Like some of them are saying that, you know, they had their first shot in one place and then they had their second shot elsewhere. But there is probably, and the number that came up in between was that it's about a true, as you said, 8% that are not getting their second shot because perhaps they had side effects from the first. And there's also some, like when we talk to our patients, we have someone who had COVID, then got the first shot and was like, really had a more significant reaction than other people. There were some doctors that, and their own physicians would be like, you know, maybe don't take the second shot yet. But what it does show you that is between scheduling and trying to get the patients to come in, and if they miss their appointment, when are they going to get their next appointment? But all of those were previous issues. Now I think that, you know, I walk by in the city, and I'm sure it's happening all over the country. You just walk by and they're like, walk in, we have the vaccine. So you could just do a walk-in appointment. So that's going to help. And also the pause on the J&J has been lifted. I think that's also going to be great because it's a one-dose vaccine. And again, the instance of severe blood clot, that was a very specific type of blood clot, was less than one in a million. And so that is actually a rare side effect. But, you know, because every side effect or every, you know, adverse effect is studied so stringently, it was important to really do that pause and take a deep dive on what was happening.
Yeah, I think one of the things we want to talk about is what we can do when we're vaccinated, because it's really amazing. The CDC came up with really kind of complicated guidelines, and then one of the people on Twitter made it a little bit less complicated. But if you are vaccinated, you have, you can do low and medium risk activities without wearing a mask, and you can wear a mask just to kind of in solidarity with the society. And then sort of high risk sort of indoor activities with a lot of people, you probably are safe without a mask. It was probably safe, for example, at the presidential address to the joint session of Congress, if everybody there was vaccinated, to not have to wear a mask. But you, again, you can wear a mask to show solidarity. If you have not been vaccinated, you really can't hardly do much of anything safely without wearing a mask. And I think, as we try to move forward, as, you know, the airlines are not selling their, are not holding their middle seats anymore, like people are filling airplanes, the more of us are, who are vaccinated, the safer it will be. We are seeing in India and Latin America, the devastation that happens with uncontrolled coronavirus.
Right. If you are looking to get vaccinated, though, there is, you can text your zip code to 438829, and then what we will get, and this is vaccines.gov, and they'll send you a list of places. You do still have to call them, but you'll find addresses and phone numbers so that you can actually try and get a vaccine. And as Suju was saying, certainly there is a ridiculous rise in numbers, and India is in crisis, as is parts of Latin America. And, you know, this is a humanitarian, it's a disaster. And there is a great need for help.
Yeah, and I think many people and many countries are stepping up to help. But this is a global pandemic. Just taking care of it in one country does not satisfy the requirements. We have to take care of it in our entire planet. You know, there are some reasons people are not getting vaccines, Marina. Maybe we can do a little quick myths versus facts about vaccines. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. We have a slide on this. There's a bunch of myths that were propagated early on. And one of them, it's a little hard to read, is, but it, the, you know, the first one is, don't get it because, you know, I've had staff say that to me, like, it just came out. I'm going to wait till December. I'm like, please don't wait till December. Like, you know, even though I reviewed the data with them. But so that's the important part. There is data. It has been thoroughly vetted. The labs were working on this type of vaccine for over 20 years. So this is definitely, it's safe. Suju, you want to do another one?
Yeah. So people think, oh, I already had COVID, so I'm immune. I don't need the vaccine. And the reality is that even if you've had COVID, and I'm glad that you've recovered from it, your antibodies are really not high enough, probably by about 2 or 3 months after. So you really do need to get the vaccine. Now, you should be aware that if you've had COVID, you may have a little bit more reaction to the vaccine than if you haven't.
Did you see that? I was peering at the slide to try and see the next one, but because it's a little bit small. But there's a bunch of things. And the other thing, the other big one was the infertility thing, that if you got the vaccine, you would be infertile. That is not accurate either. That is just a bald-faced lie. And so, you know, definitely think on getting the vaccine if you can. And this will help everybody. I mean, we do still need to get to herd immunity.
Yeah, we really do. We want to bring on our guests, but first I want to give a big apology to Marina. She gets my society's name wrong, and I got her society completely wrong last week.
I was wondering why that was on there.
Yes. Marina has been elected the Secretary Treasurer of the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, which is a big deal. And she will be president of that society in a couple of years. And I was so proud of you that I completely mangled the name of the society.
It's
so
okay.
Congratulations again, Marina.
Thank you so much. Thanks again. And now on to our fantastic guests. We also want to thank our corporate sponsor, which is ENT and Allergy Associates. You can actually call and get COVID testing there too, or if you have allergies, which by the way, allergy season is kicking up high. But they have over 40 locations in New York City, Long Island, Westchester, and New Jersey. And there's a number if you're interested in getting an appointment there, 1-855-ENTA-DOC. Entidoc. I like it.
Yeah, Entidoc. It's very cute. We're live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Shree's LinkedIn. Please like and share and tag your friends, because we are going to meet some amazing physician advocates today. We have Dr. Michelle Au, which is the greatest way to spell A-U for an anesthesiologist. Wait, greatest way to pronounce it. Dr. Michelle Au is an anesthesiologist and a state senator in Georgia's District 48. And Dr. Carrie Yerge, who is a trauma surgeon and a leader in pre-hospital care. So welcome to both of you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having us.
No, we're so thrilled to have you guys. So, you know, I think COVID around the country is kind of coming down a little bit, which is great, unlike as we were talking about other countries. But, you know, in terms of your responsibilities during this pandemic, well, if we start with you, Carrie, how was it different? Was it quieter? Or did you have to, you know, did you yourself deploy to other areas to try and make, you know, make things work out in your different hospital systems?
Yeah, I did. We initially in Riverside saw a slowdown in the trauma and general surgery volumes. And so initially the focus was on gearing up for, as also a boarded intensivist, getting called into the COVID ICU. So that was really the first part of the preparation. And then I spent, I want to say upwards of 6 months, working in the COVID ICU over in Phoenix. So it's been a little bit different. I'm not sure if you guys have been doing as much bariatric surgery or not, as well during this time period, but it's been a little bit of a shift in practice.
A very interesting time to be an anesthesiologist and be a physician legislator, especially a new one in the state of Georgia. So basically my focus since the onset of the COVID epidemic has been twofold. First one is clinical, just like we've all been doing, working with our patients. Since I'm an anesthesiologist, we did do a lot of, especially early on, manning the emergency airway team, and especially last spring when COVID numbers were peaking for the first time, doing a lot of those emergency intubations in the ICU and emergency room setting. As a physician legislator, however, what I've been focusing on is trying to do a lot of the public health communication that I think is important for people to hear, both from a medical expert, someone with a background in public health, and someone who does work on the government level to help facilitate people getting access to the resources they need. So a lot of what I've been trying to do, aside from legislative work, is doing communication on our social media, releasing videos about vaccines, how they work, trying to demystify some of, you know, like the myths that you guys were talking about. Try to make people feel more comfortable with the idea of getting vaccinated, why it's important, and just really breaking down the barriers to people getting access to care.
You know, we have people watching from all over. Miriam Berkeley says hello from Hell's Kitchen in New York City, which is not at all hellish and really a lovely place to be.
Not anymore.
Well, yeah. Mark Lee is watching from Durham, North Carolina. He actually has a podcast and a radio show, which really disperses wonderful information to people. Maria Zachariah is watching from India. Iral Braganza is watching from the UK. My parents are watching from New York City and say congratulations to you, Marina. You know, we are going to talk about medicine, but we're going to talk about health equity. So maybe let's talk about what is health equity, because it's a term that doctors use a lot. And maybe patients don't know what that means, or people don't know what that means. So, Michelle, can you tell us what it means to have an equitable healthcare system?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because a lot of the reason that I decided to run for office is because what we realize sort of really early on in our medical training, and when I say early on, I mean like within the first few years of med school, is that a lot of what we do for patients once they get to us at the hospital, at the bedside, in the OR, is really too late, right? Because by the time they get to us, it's very downstream to be able to fix a lot of the issues that made them sick in the first place, right? And when I talk about those issues, we get into talking about what we in the public health field call the social determinants of health. when we think about access to healthcare, we tend to think very proximate to our interaction with them. So we try to think about, like, you know, health insurance and like drug pricing and interventions and, you know, treatments, surgeries, these kinds of things. But really the things that dictate the health of the community overall are bigger social issues like access to quality education, access to economic opportunity, you know, access to health insurance. These are the types of things that really dictate larger community health issues, and access to these factors and the things that impede our access are where the issues of social equity and health come in.
Carrie, you do a lot with patient advocacy and you do sort of pre-hospital advocacy. So maybe you can explain to us what that means.
There are a lot of communities that have a dearth of pre-hospital resources. So for instance, what does that mean? It means that there are communities in America where an ambulance, should there be a medical emergency or a shooting or someone is actively bleeding, where an ambulance is upwards of 15 to 30 minutes away. There are huge proportions of the United States specifically where we don't have access to pre-hospital care. And unfortunately, that tends to affect specific communities. So if you're talking about health equity, part of the goal of what we've been working with in the pre-hospital community is building up rural trauma systems and enhancing the education and skill set of pre-hospital providers to kind of step in and fill that gap to buy time until patients can come and meet us in the hospital in the trauma bay. Only because there aren't enough hospitals, there aren't enough trauma centers in the country per population, and we're trying to minimize the impact that that has on, especially in rural communities.
You know, and it is so important that people understand it's really, sometimes you think, oh, it's rural America that's having all these problems, and it's absolutely not the case. It can happen in many areas in our country that are not considered rural, but even in suburbia. And honestly, in New York City, you know, we can get an ambulance really fast, but one traffic jam, it takes so much time. Like my patients leaving the hospital, it could be an hour to go to New Jersey or it could be an hour to go to Brooklyn, depending on the time of day that they leave, right? So there's so many things that impact, but it's so important to have a process and a protocol for all of that. This pandemic, you know, I think, as you pointed out, Carrie, earlier, that trauma was decreased and even general surgery emergencies, which we all saw, which was odd. But when we did see general surgery emergencies, they were far more sick. And thankfully, the trauma stuff was down. It's like a balance, right? Pandemic, really hot, trauma down. Things are coming back a little bit. But, you know, one of the issues that happened during this pandemic was that women were disproportionately affected by everything that happened from, you know, homeschooling was significantly impactful, more for women than men. And then even being at home and everyone being at home and trying to find a space for everyone to do work. So this is a slide that talks about how much money women lost in income last year. And the crazy thing about it is that little bullet that says that's $800 billion, that's more than the combined gross domestic product of 98 countries, and that women lost 5 million jobs in 2020. So this was not a banner year at all for women.
And in fact, they were more penalized if they had children than men were if they had children. And concomitant to the job losses and the financial losses, we are seeing both internal emotional stressors. So we're seeing a lot more anxiety and depression, fatigue. In fact, drinking, women unfortunately have been drinking much more than in response to these. 33% have anxiety or depression. 27% are having other psychological illnesses. In this study in Australia, there was almost a 3,000% increase in need for mental health services for women during the pandemic. But we are also seeing that they're dipping into their financial reserves. And unfortunately, we have seen a heightened number of domestic partner violence problems, both for primarily to women, sometimes to men, as the victim, and we're seeing a lot more child abuse. And Carrie, maybe you can talk to us a bit about what we should look for if we are suspecting domestic partner violence when a woman comes in.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back to when the trauma volumes and the general surgery volumes went down, what we were seeing was kind of a shocking increase in intimate partner violence, child abuse, and then also substance abuse. And so we ended up, unfortunately, in those cases, the trauma surgery team is often activated as well. And so I think that we, as trauma surgeons, we keep kind of our antenna raised for a couple of things. So particularly in children, we get called for any cases where there's suspected non-accidental trauma in children. And what you'll see is trauma to head and face, bruising, particularly around the eyes. We've seen a lot of that recently. And then any kind of patterned bruising. It's very unusual for children to fall on linear objects. So if you see bruises that look like a straight line, that often is from a cable or a wire or a belt. So patterned bruising, really anything around the perineum or the genital area of children, is of concern. And then, you know, again, anything that's patterned, so anything that looks like a handprint or a footprint, it would be pretty hard to imagine how that could be an accidental bruise. So we, like I said, unfortunately, particularly in my role at RUHS, saw a profound amount of child abuse. Those cases are just devastating to see. I'm sure that you, each of you in your careers has experienced or has had some contact with those cases, and it's just heartbreaking to see.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's, and you see the flip side of it. Like my daughter did fall on you know, she tripped in her room and she landed on the side of the trundle and then had a bone bruise and took her to the ER. And thankfully, I mean, this is not a story because I'm not complaining. I thought it was great. They were looking at me. And it's the hospital I worked at. The ortho resident was like, do you mind if we talk to your daughter alone? I was like, oh, no, go ahead. Talk to her alone. That's fine. You know, and I think that suspicion should be there. And, you know, in her case, as she'll tell everyone, she's a little klutzy, so she's fallen a couple of times, you know, but it is important that people check in and understand what they're looking for, and that kids can get injured in odd ways. And I love all the places you said, you know, anything in the perianal area or perineum. The thing that struck me on that slide was the frenulum, and that is under your tongue and attaches to the inside of your mouth. And I was like, you know, Suju does a surgery, she's ENT for tongue tied, right? You can release the frenulum. But
right.
So what is that injury? Like,
I think it's pulling. I think it has to do with pulling the tongue, pulling the ears, the sort of like, I'm going to box you kind of thing. I mean, it's very violent and it's very hard to think about it anytime Sunday morning or otherwise. The other thing that slide shows is a series of x-rays. So if the emergency room thinks that this may be a child abuse situation, they will do a series of x-rays to determine whether this is really something of concern. I just want to say domestic violence, child abuse have gone up a lot during the pandemic. Because we are isolated in our homes, there's a lot of tension and stress. We talked to both Donna Mazik and Robin Kogan, who are excellent school nurses, about the fact that schools are not there to help identify these children. Workplaces are not there for women to reach out. There is a code when you're on a Zoom call. If you put your thumb in and close your fingers over it, it is a way to tell people on the Zoom call that you're in trouble. I'm not in trouble. I'm just showing you the code. So if you put your thumb in and you close your fingers, you can indicate non-verbally on a call that something bad is happening in your house and please send help. There are other things that women are using. They're calling 911 and they're ordering a pizza, right? So they're calling 911 and the operator says, what's your emergency? I need a pepperoni pizza. This is my address. Please bring it as quickly as possible. The operator is saying, you know, does he have a gun? The woman can say, yes, I told you, extra, you know, something like that. So I think there are different ways that people are trying to communicate when they are in crisis that are very important for people to know. We could talk about this alone, but we have these two experts with us and we want to talk about a number of things. So maybe Marina, I'll have you take it away to the next subject.
Well, you know, actually, the partner violence is so horrible, and also the child abuse. We were just talking before about how so many things that we want to talk about, and yet one thing that we have to talk about is really the gun violence in this country and how many shootings we've had, like on the daily, right? Every day we're hearing about it, and what Michelle, you and Carrie are both doing as advocates to try and discuss and at least have the discussion on this, because this is something that in this country we're at such an impasse over. And the moment you start talking about guns and restricting access, everyone literally gets up in arms, literal. And the issue is not that you can't have a gun. The issue is that if you have a mental health disorder, if there's any question about your past, dubious past, that there should be background checks on people. I think that is an appropriate intervention. If my friends are watching, I'm not trying to take your guns away. I'm just saying that there are some people who probably shouldn't have a gun, and it's important to identify them. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Michelle, can we start with you?
Yeah, thank you for bringing up this issue. I think that it's a uniquely American public health crisis, this issue of gun violence. And we've seen it more and more. I think that we've seen a lot of it sort of more showily in the news in the past few weeks and months. But really, this epidemic has been going on for many decades. And even when it's not couched in the setting of mass shootings, which I think tend to get the most attention because they're very large scale and public, and they tend to get carried on the news, that gun violence has been happening all along. And even though it seemed like there was a little bit of a lull during the sort of higher peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, really gun violence has gone up in the past year because of a lot of the reasons that we talked about in terms of increasing in depression, suicidality, domestic violence, these types of things that don't tend to make the news, unfortunately, but are a really serious harbinger of the type of gun violence that we see in the United States. You know, I'm a legislator in the state of Georgia, which is in the South. So obviously there's a very strong culture of gun rights here, and it's been very difficult to even have these conversations in a public forum in the state legislature and to get any legislation about gun safety moved, because people, I think you're right, tend to frame it as taking guns away from people. What I'd like to point out is that increasing gun safety and increasing the culture of safety around gun ownership does not mean taking guns away. Right? The same way that increasing vehicular safety or driving safety doesn't mean no cars, right? We have to find a way to be able to be safer in this environment and decrease gun violence in all its forms, right? And we have to remember also that gun violence, just like any other public health issue, has many different ideologies. It has many different risk groups, and it presents in many different ways. So it's not just all mass shootings. In fact, the majority of gun violence cases are in the form of suicide. Suicide accounts for about 60% of cases of gun violence we see. There are many different forms of gun violence, and there's many different ways that they manifest, different risk groups, and different ways to treat this problem. So we really need to stop talking about it like there's going to be one single solution for the problem of gun violence. There are lots of different solutions and lots of different things that we're going to need to try and layer on top of each other to get more safety in our community so that we can coexist with people who are law-abiding gun owners.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what a uniquely American problem this is. Unfortunately, trauma surgeons in this country, where we could be focusing on other injury profiles, we unfortunately are becoming de facto subject matter experts on gun violence, particularly high velocity wounds, which are a different profile and a different pattern and cause more devastating injuries. And I want to come back to this later on. This is a scientific problem. I think that the only way that we're going to eventually be able to make any headway is to study this the way that we study any other disease. And so I wanted to answer your question, which I think is a good one. Unfortunately, the trauma community in the United States is involved after the fact. We don't seem to have the ability yet in this country to stop this gun violence. And so what I've been involved in teaching is essentially law enforcement and fire EMS, teaching them how to keep our patients alive who are actively bleeding and at risk of losing their lives from hemorrhagic shock, from bleeding to death, essentially. How do we keep those patients alive and safe until they can get into the hands of a trauma surgeon? It really breaks my heart that we need to teach stop the bleed in elementary schools to teachers. But unfortunately, we've demonstrated with some of the slides that we've shown, we absolutely do. This is a major issue now. And so one of the things that I'm involved in that the American College of Surgeons and the Committee on Trauma specifically has pushed really effectively, I think, is the Stop the Bleed campaign. With the help of governance and leadership in this country, we are teaching how to use tourniquets and how to use direct pressure to stop patients from bleeding until EMS or transport can bring those patients to the hospital.
So can you just describe for us the graphic that we're seeing? Like, what is it when you say stop the bleed, what should a normal person caught in a terrible situation know that will help this patient live and save their limb?
Yeah. So the biggest risk to anybody who's actively bleeding is that ongoing bleeding is going to cause shock and then ultimately death. And so in these situations, we don't worry about airway. We don't do support breathing or chest compressions. The first and most important thing is using your hands, particularly your fingertips if you can, or a fist or an elbow, to provide really hard direct pressure over top of the bleeding wound. And that's what you see, I think, up at the top of that slide. If you happen to have access to gauze, you can pack junctional wounds, so wounds that are in the neck, in the armpits, or in the groin. But really, the hallmark, I think, of Stop the Bleed is the emphasis on pre-hospital tourniquets, so having access to an approved or a Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care recommended tourniquet is really ultimately going to be a life-saving measure. And that gets put on high and tight, so all the way up in the armpit or all the way up as high as you can go on the leg, at least at first, and then tighten down as hard as you can to cut off blood flow to that extremity to stop the bleeding in order to save the patient's life.
And the other important thing, because, you know, we talk about life and limb, right? And the important thing is on this slide, it says, if you can, write the time or let, when EMS comes, to let them know what time you did this so that you can talk about the duration of limb ischemia, which obviously is going to impact when you take the tourniquet off or control the bleed and hopefully salvage the leg or the arm. So important. This is something that is supported, I believe, in all states. I know New York is definitely doing it. The American College of Surgeons, as you said, you're working with them. So we do this in New York State. I was the former ACS chapter president for New York. We do this as well and teach around the state. It is so important that people do understand. And it is, in a way, super important. Everyone should know how to do it. But as you said, we're treating the result, and we're not treating the inciting issue, which is that, you know, there's mass shootings or just shootings in general. And one of the slides we have talks about, first of all, the slide that we have on the U.S. having the most guns. And then there's just another slide that we have too that talks about, which states have per capita guns and the instance of injury. And I think, Michelle, you had brought up the point that, you know, almost two-thirds of gun deaths are actually suicides. And you can see, you know, the number of deaths per year, especially on the yellow slide with the graph, you know, the higher you go, and on the x-axis, which is a lower one, you're really looking at the percentage of gun ownership within the state and then how that relates to deaths. And you see it's a fairly linear line. Love to hear your comments.
Yeah, I think that when we talk about gun violence as a public health issue, we have to remember that the crux of public health approaches in general is prevention, right? Which I think is what you were getting at. And while it's obviously good to know how to treat mass casualties when they happen, and we're all trained to do that, I think that Stop the Bleed program is great. I've gone through it myself. We really need to concentrate on legislative solutions to prevent this gun violence from happening at all in any of its forms. I think two very reasonable types of gun legislation that have been proposed and that we're trying to work through, both in the state of Georgia and on a federal level. First one has to do with universal background checks. I think everyone has heard about this, and it's actually the one type of gun safety legislation that is nearly universally popular on both sides of the aisle, that people understand and want. Tightening of background checks for people who are purchasing firearms. I proposed a piece of legislation in the Georgia State Legislature that would close the loophole on private gun sales and transfers, which do not have to go through background checks at this moment. And on the federal level in Congress, the House has passed H.R. 8, which seeks to do much of the same thing. And now it's coming before the Senate, which hopefully will do the right thing, though, as we mentioned, this issue is very entrenched. One second issue that I'd like to bring up is this issue of waiting periods. I proposed a piece of legislation that mandated a 5-day waiting period after deciding to purchase a firearm and receiving it. And that would have to do with building in a sort of cooling off period for people, especially with people who are in a mental health crisis, people who are suicidal, people who are homicidal. Having a cooling period built in so that they cannot buy a gun and use it that same day to kill themselves or hurt other people. We saw this actually right here in Atlanta, that the gunman in the Atlanta spa shootings had purchased his firearm that very morning and used it that afternoon to shoot and kill 8 people. So this is the type of very common sense gun legislation that I would like to continue to work on. And this is sort of the public health approach of prevention that we need to focus on in dealing with gun violence.
So one of our viewers, Ellen Austin, is saying what many of us feel every time. You know, yesterday there was a mass shooting in a casino, and, you know, people were out and about, they're vaccinated, they're trying to get back to their lives. And we see the horror that unfolded in Atlanta. We see yesterday, we can sit and name for an hour all of the shootings we know about. I think hearing from legislators, especially in states where, there are more guns and more concerns about gun ownership, talking about this common sense legislation is really important. I think we can't allow this to continue. This is an unchecked public health crisis that's continuing. Thank you both so much for talking to us. Kedar Ramanathan wrote in that he learned about tourniquets and how to apply them in health class in high school. And I think one of the kids in my town did an Eagle Scout project on teaching Stop the Bleed in the schools. And I think obviously, you know, the more we can know to help people as civilians, the more we can then as physicians help people.
Do you guys think that we've become so inured to death, like as physicians? You know, a death, a loss of a life, especially if it's, you know, one of your patients, or if you're helping out on something, anytime you even hear about it, it's just such a devastation. You know exactly, because we've seen this in our careers, and it's our compassion that speaks, that we know that a loss of a life is so tragic. And yet, every day we're seeing people just, you know, it seems almost willy-nilly, just taking life. Like, they don't see the value of human life. And that, to me, is also this big problem. And I don't know when this became like okay, and how impaired we are now when we hear about another shooting. Like, okay, so there was a shooting at the casino. You just mentioned it. So, you know, I'm like, no, yeah, that's terrible. It is horrible. And yet people are out there with their, with just, it's a crime. Hello, it's homicide. And just going out and using their guns, and just the disrespect, and then their own lack of respect for their own life after, right? They take a few people out, and then they don't, you know, face the piper. They don't feel the guilt. They just take themselves out of the picture as well. Like, it's just horrible. And it just really speaks to this complete lack of appreciation for life.
Yeah, you know,
I was going to say this is a uniquely American problem,
yes,
right? And I think,
yeah,
we all have mentioned that we have become so inured and so calcified to this, that this is just how it is. This is how we live, right? And we can't even figure out why the flags are at half mast anymore. Like, you can't even recover from the news of one mass shooting or mass casualty before another one happens, right? It takes sometimes talking to people from outside of America to realize how abnormal this is, and we do not have to live like this.
I was going to exactly say that. So many of our colleagues from around the country have never taken care of a gunshot wound victim, ever. And I'm like, how is that possible? Like, it's unfortunately so common in the U.S. Yet, yesterday, that shooting in the casino in Wisconsin, one of our colleagues, an emergency medicine doctor, tweeted that she was actually at the casino, and the Twitter thread breaks your heart. She's like, I don't know what's going on. Can somebody, I'm in this casino. I'm with some older woman. I'm trying to help her. She's been vaccinated. I allowed her to take her mask off. You know, it's like this confluence of terrible things. And she got out and she found her husband who was somewhere else. But, you know, we have, we can't become numb. We can't not see the violence that's happening. We have another crisis, unfortunately, that is also very American, which is the opioid crisis in the United States. And we are seeing that, I think, concomitant with all the financial issues and the stress and the anxiety and the isolation, opioid deaths reached new heights during the pandemic. You can see that fentanyl and other synthetic opioids just skyrocketed in terms of causes of death during 2020 and continuing into 2021. The map shows that it's essentially a problem all across America, with pockets where it's more common. We've talked about the opioid crisis on this show before, and initially it was blamed on doctors for giving too much pain medication after surgery. Too many prescriptions that started in the 90s. And the second wave is the access to heroin, which was very cheap, which is growing, growing, growing. But now we're seeing these synthetic street drugs that are really taking lives. And Dr. Al, Michelle, as an anesthesiologist, you use fentanyl all the time. So can you explain to us what's happening with the drug and then what's happening in this crisis?
To talk about the opioid crisis, we really do have to talk about a little bit of history. And I think you alluded to it a little bit. I do a talk that we can chat about some other time about the history of the opioid epidemic. And a lot of it, people point to this phenomenon from, I think, when we were younger, or maybe in training, about this focus on pain and the focus on treating pain readily and quickly in our patients. And I think this was well-intentioned. Obviously, no one likes to see patients in pain. But this fell at a moment where the pharmaceutical company was really trying to push products that they could profit off of, and which they marketed as much more safe than it turned out that they were. In terms of fentanyl, I think that this is a readily available, cheaply manufactured synthetic opioid, which is much more powerful than some of the others we had seen available to patients and addicts on the street prior. And I think that that accounts for a lot of the spike in fatalities that we see in the opioid epidemic, because it is so much more potent. And the effects that we see on our patients who are maybe not used to that level of opioid effect accounts for a lot of the overdoses that we've been seeing, because patients have become addicted and need to continue to feed this addiction in order to, you know, to stay even keeled.
And then that's also something that they have, they build a tolerance to a certain amount of drug, and then they keep chasing that high and end up taking more and more drugs. Carrie, can you discuss that and also talk about what options or what can be done to try and stem that tide of deaths from the opioids?
There are certain parts of taking in opiates that your body gets used to, and some parts that that your body doesn't get used to. And unfortunately, the sensation of high, because of the way that the drugs work, you just have to chase it and chase it and chase it with increasing and increasing and increasing doses of whatever it is that you're taking. And the problem that we're seeing, and the way that we, I think, can address some of that, especially on the inpatient side, as a surgeon, we deal, especially a trauma surgeon, we deal with patients who are in pain pretty much every day. And I think we have learned how to emphasize non-opiate and multimodal. So you're using, for instance, anti-inflammatories plus a nerve pain type medication to try and decrease the dosing of opiates that we're using. And that's, you know, kind of a very narrowly focused way to address a small piece of this problem. And then on the larger, from the larger perspective, I think that we've done a reasonable job at making the antidote more readily available. So Narcan is really standard issue now for a lot of law enforcement agencies, interestingly enough, because they tend to be the first responders to these events. To an opiate overdose. EMS has access, but then I think, as you know, Dr. Au, I think, has a good and important role in making this readily available, essentially, I mean, over the counter. I'm almost a little bit hesitant to say that, because it is a medication that needs to be administered, you know, carefully and under monitoring. But it also has the capacity to save lives and to allow people to make mistakes in the setting of addiction without losing their life over it. And so I want to turn it back to you all for more of a discussion on Narcan, but I do think that that's a band-aid on a much bigger problem. You know, the absence of compassion and empathy, but also all of these numbing behaviors that we're seeing, especially in the pandemic, because there's so much pain and despair. It shouldn't surprise any of us to see opiate use and opiate overdoses going up. And I think Narcan, while an imperfect solution, is one that we need to, I think, really lean into for now, until we can address the underlying roots of the opiate epidemic.
Yeah, I think we saw, I think that is words of such wisdom, Carrie, because we do need compassion. We do need understanding. We need human interaction, right? It goes back to get a vaccine so we can actually see each other, please. We need, you know, therapists. We had the highest rate of medical students going into psychiatry this year than we've ever seen. Over 6% matched into psychiatry this year. We need services that are compassionate. We need communities to be able to come back together. If you suspect that somebody has an opioid, an opiate overdose, so they've taken a drug that has knocked them out. They're cold. They're not waking up. Their mental status is different. And you give them Narcan, and you can save them, right? You can, if it's an opioid overdose, you can bring them back, and then they can get care in the hospital. What if it's not? What if they're actually a diabetic, and they're having those same symptoms because they're in a sort of a diabetic coma? Can I hurt somebody by giving them Narcan in the field, Dr. Al?
Well, Narcan is an antagonist of opioid-based pain medication, so I don't think it's going to necessarily hurt them to give it. You know, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. I am a proponent of making Narcan more readily available. I think that actually when we write prescriptions for opioids for patients who are leaving the hospital and going home on even a short course of opioid-based pain medications, it is a good idea to maybe give family members access to having Narcan in the house. Even just knowing that being on even a very short course of post-op opioids, I'm talking about 3 to 5 days post-op, can increase your risk of relapse and addiction even up to a year afterwards. So this is the kind of thing that we want to prepare people for. And again, public health is about prevention. So obviously we don't want to have patients be in these situations, but it's also about knowing the risk factors and enabling people to deal with this risk.
Michelle, one of the other things when we were talking, and Perry, you mentioned also this, the need for mental health professionals. There's definitely a need, but the other important part is actually getting it paid for. And, you know, some of the institutions, like all the hospital-based insurers, you know, were because the hospitals were saying you have to supply, you know, mental health programs, et cetera. And every hospital, I think, has probably generated a program or a system or method for providers, healthcare providers to reach out. But the majority of people still need it. And if you can't get it paid for and you only have X amount of dollars to subsist on, then how are you going to get that mental health thing? It should be one of those universal access things. I think that will really help.
So what do you say, Michelle? What can you do as a legislator in terms of access to mental health care?
Yeah, I think mental health is always chronically underfunded. And every time I look at the state budget and look at the federal budget, it seems like that's the area that the funding is getting whittled away little by little. What we have to remember, especially with the opioid epidemic, is actually mental health funding would both help with prevention of opioid addiction and overdose and also help with treatment, right? We have to remember that opioid addiction is a disease. It is not a value judgment that we should be applying to people that, we don't castigate people for having diabetes or having cancer either, right? These are medical problems that we need to treat. And we need to realize that funding for mental health is an investment in the health of our community. I know it feels abstract. It feels probably for a lot of people like the money is going towards nothing, especially when it's for prevention. But this is how we get to the root of the problem, and it's money well spent. And the benefits far outweigh the costs in the end.
You know, we have had such an amazing time talking with both of you and learning so much. We could ask you about everything, but I'd like to know what advice you would give for physicians, nurses, healthcare providers, and non-medical people who want to get more active in advocacy. So maybe I'll start with you, Carrie.
I would say, you know, absent of a large platform, either a governmental position or a lot of money or a lot of power, what I've tried to focus on are the little things that are within my reach, within my grasp. Bruises on a child that don't necessarily make sense to me, that the story that was told. And we all have kids and loved ones in our community that we, in the back of our head, have a suspicion that maybe there's something going on there that we're not aware of. And so I will defer all of the big picture solutions to Dr. Au. I think she's done a beautiful job and has an amazing platform. For me, it's been focusing on the lives that I can touch individually every day. And you don't have to be a physician to do that. I mean, learning how to stop the bleed or carrying Narcan, those are things that pretty much anybody can do. And again, not preventative, those are reactive. We're not preventing the problems, but as a single individual who doesn't always feel so powerful, those are the things that give me hope that I can have an impact.
Three very short things. One is we need you in here. Any physician who is interested in doing public advocacy and advocacy for their patients, we need you. One easy way to get involved is through your state or national professional societies. Every state and national society has a legislative arm, has an advocacy arm. And they would love to have you get involved. I got involved through the GSA, the Georgia Society of Anesthesiologists, and the American Society of Anesthesiologists, and they do a great job. Second thing is that we have to remember that we have a lot of power and a lot of voice, even if we don't feel like it, as individuals working in the hospital or working in our clinics. People don't always trust politicians, right? In fact, people mostly don't trust politicians, but they still trust doctors and nurses and healthcare practitioners. So use your voice well. Know that people are listening to you and trust you for good advice. Write op-eds, speak publicly, use your social media wisely to communicate the things that you think people want to know. And the third thing is that we do need more physicians and healthcare advocates in legislatures. So if you are even considering running for office, even if you think, I could never do that, I didn't think I could do it either, right? But it's something where you see a need, and I think that all medical people want to be ultimately of use. You want to be useful. You want to use your skills for good. So it's something that I think more people should consider.
Absolutely. That is so great. And if you're watching and you're fired up, that's so exciting and definitely something that you can do and act locally and even nationally. So thank you both of our guests, Dr. Al, Dr. Jurgi, for joining us. We want to thank our producers. We also want to thank our sponsor, which is ENT Allergy and Associates, for joining us. Now, next week, we are off for Mother's Day, but we'll be back on the 16th with a great show. Again, thank you to our viewers.
And we'll be carried on WBAI on Mondays from 2 to 3. Happy Mother's Day next week, everybody.
She was walking in the street, looked up and noticed he was nameless, he was homeless. She asked him his name and told him what hers was.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here's some headlines for this hour. Today, President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden spoke to Tidewater Community College in Norfolk, Virginia, to discuss the American Families Plan, which the White House describes as an investment in the country's children and families, helping families cover the basic expenses that so many struggle with now, as well as lowering health insurance premiums. The president also added this about the American Families Plan.
And all the data shows will cut child poverty in half this year. Cut it in half. My plan extends the tax credit at least through the year 2025. Because what's going to happen in 2025, as the press knows, is the tax cuts of the last president expire. And we're going to go back that put us $2 trillion in debt. And then we're going to compete as to what tax credits there are. I think it's about time we start giving tax breaks and tax credits to working class families and middle class families instead of just the very wealthy.
President Biden went on to say that he plans on, quote, making everyone pay their fair share as far as taxes are concerned. Now to your COVID-19 update. Here are the numbers. Worldwide, there are more than 153.8 million confirmed coronavirus infections and upwards of 3.2 million known deaths. In this country alone, there are more than 33.1 million confirmed coronavirus infections and over 591,000 known deaths. However, more than 604 million people have been vaccinated globally, with at least 147 million being in the United States. Although more than half of all adults in the U.S. have received at least one vaccine dose, daily vaccination rates are slipping, and there is widespread consensus among scientists and public health experts that the desired goal of herd immunity is not attainable, at least not in the foreseeable future, and perhaps not ever. Just what is herd immunity, though? Well, it's a form of indirect protection from infectious disease that can occur when a sufficient percentage of a population has become immune to an infection. So, health officials are saying that rather than attain herd immunity, COVID-19 will most likely become a manageable threat that will continue to circulate in the United States for years to come, still causing hospitalizations and deaths, but in much smaller numbers. How much smaller is uncertain and depends in part on how much of the nation and the world becomes vaccinated, as well as how the coronavirus evolves. However, it is already clear that the virus is changing too quickly, new variants are spreading too easily, and vaccination is proceeding too slowly for herd immunity to be within reach anytime soon. Lastly, in city news, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced today during a press briefing that the Empire State is lifting capacity limits for most businesses beginning May 19th. Restaurants, museums, theaters, retail stores, and other businesses will be allowed to reopen at full capacity as long as 6 feet of social distancing space is maintained in New York as well as neighboring New Jersey and Connecticut. Governor Cuomo called the New York's reopening, quote, measured and phased. In Washington, D.C., for those who ride the subway, please note there will be no train service between Fort Totten and Prince George's Plaza stations starting today through to Sunday, May 9th. Free shuttle buses will run between Fort Totten, West Hyattsville, and PG Plaza. Yellow Line trains will operate between Huntington and Reagan National Airport and between Franconia Springfield and Mount Vernon Square. Green Line trains will operate between Branch Avenue and Fort Totten and between PG Plaza and Greenbelt. In today's weather, it's currently about 65 degrees in New York and 75 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe and thank you for listening.